We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. He is Mr. Stanley J. Blitz, and he's the author of a book called Bandstand, The Untold Story. Welcome to the show, Stan.
My pleasure, Ronnie.
Let's begin with a little bit of theme music that people are familiar with. Bandstand Boogie, you think of American Bandstand, and you think of Dick Clark, of course. Stan, you wrote this book in 1997, which is 13 years ago. At the time, you made the statement that if you were to ask anybody on the street who was familiar with American Bandstand, or Bandstand, if you want to use the generic term, and you asked them who originated the show, at the time in this book, you said 92% of Americans would say Dick Clark. Has that changed over the last 13 years, do you think?
Well, it's gone higher, the percentage, because this is really, Ronnie, a Philadelphia story. Anybody outside of the Delaware Valley really and truly know only Dick Clark. They never heard of Bob Horn, the creator of the show, because they buried this and the information until my book came out. Because I never bought the story growing up in Philadelphia, and that's why I decided to title it Bandstand, The Untold Story, 1949 to 1956, How the Show Evolved into American Bandstand.
I'm going to skip, if it's okay, to the very end of the book on page 226. You have a letter that was written shortly after the death of Bob Horn. It was written by Anthony Mamarella, better known as Tony Mamarella. He was the producer of American Bandstand, but prior to that, he was the producer of Bob Horn's Bandstand.
That is correct.
And this is what he says about Bob Horn. Now, this is not conjecture. This is fact, according to the man who knew them both. Tony writes, "If Bob Horn was nothing else, he was the originator and creator of Bandstand shows. It was his idea, his title, his brainchild, and it had international significance. Bandstand shows now exist in all parts of the world. Dick Clark replaced Bob Horn as MC on Bandstand, which, by the way, originated in the WFIL-TV studios in Philadelphia. Under the guidance of Bob Horn, the Bandstand show was the highest-rated local daytime show in the USA. Dick took it from there to the top network daytime show as American Bandstand on ABC TV. And Tony goes on and says, dig up any story you want about the guy, but remember also to print this, referring to Bob Horn. He was a pro in every sense of the word. He could smell a hit in the first eight bars. He didn't have to wait for Cashbox Billboard or the Gavin Sheet to tell him. He was a leader and innovator because he was tuned to the people in his audience and not to the people in the trade. If all you can say about him is that he was a leader in today's era of the automated follower, that's saying a lot. Bob Horn was everything you have heard about him, but he was my friend. I only regret that I was not close to him these last few years to tell him so. I hope he knew."
Tony was the closest person to Bob because he was the producer of the show for day one in 1952, when it was called Bob Horn's Bandstand. And he also was the producer for Dick Clark's American Bandstand in Philadelphia, not in Los Angeles, because the impact of the show, Ronnie, was not in Los Angeles. It was in Philadelphia. It was on 5 days a week after school. 52 to 63 were the impact years. And when I lecture, I have to point out to them, this was probably the most powerful variety show in the history of afternoon television. 5 days a week, and it was live.
It was George Tomsko of the Fireballs put me in touch with you and recommended that I should do this particular show with you. So hello to George.
George, you know how much I love you, man. Okay? And the Fireballs will get their due respect with me alive, so I will take care of the Fireballs.
Stan, I read your book twice. And the first time I read it like any other reader would do. I didn't make any scribble notes or anything. I just wanted to read the book from cover to cover. And then I read it a second time, but the second time through I took some copious notes. And I want to let people know what your book is before we start talking about Bob Horn, the personality. Unfortunately, there are certain people who wanted to basically pretend he didn't even exist. As far as your book is concerned, it's a mix of absolute, total facts based upon research that you've done, and also a bit of conjecture on your part, because like a good mystery novel, for example, there's a lot of things sometimes that are not that clear. There's a lot of gray areas. But to your credit, Stan, you make it very clear in the writing of this book, what parts of the book are facts and what parts are conjecture on your part, and you invite the reader to basically be the judge and jury on their own.
You're absolutely right, Ronnie. That's definitely the way it was perceived.
At the end of the show, I'm going to tell all of you how you can get a copy of the book. The book is in print, and you can get it directly from the author. I have to tell you that apart from the writing of the book, you know, they say one picture is worth 1,000 words. In the middle of the book, there's pages and pages of pictures, including the 1955 Bandstand Yearbook. And all I can say is this is something that you have to see because I can't describe it. There's just so much in here that is so fascinating, and if you want to have an idea of what started out as Bob Horn's Bandstand was like before Dick Clark took over the show, there is no better book in existence than this one.
Thank you, Ronnie. I appreciate it.
So these pictures are just phenomenal. I can get immersed in them. Now we begin the story of Bob Horn. Who was Bob Horn? Bob Horn was from Philadelphia?
Well, that isn't even a controversy. They said he was from West Virginia. Then what I did, right when the book came out, about 1997,
right,
I discovered he worked in Berks County, which is Reading area.
Okay.
And there was a museum in Reading. I had something planned on a Friday night with Berks County, and it was an event, man. I had planned dancers to dance the old bunny hop and the jitterbug and everything. And had a disc jockey from, because Bob started out on WRAW in Berks County, which is still in existence, and I was interviewed by that station.
The Reading area of Pennsylvania?
Right. He paid his dues. He had a musical background. He was a musician. He learned music when he was a young man. He worked in janitorial. He worked the ground up. He started off WRAW in Reading in the 30s, because he was born about 1915. So he started when he was about 19 years old. He really learned the business. He had a beautiful voice. He was the voice of D-Day in 1945 when the war ended, June 6, 1945. He had a very distinct voice. I met his widow, but his daughter said I sounded almost like her father, my voice.
Oh.
Tremendous compliment. Yeah, and Bob went out to California, and he really was quite successful out in California. But he had an offer from WIP, which is one of Metro Media in Philadelphia. And he came back to the East Coast about 1946, 1947. And he worked with two people I'm sure your people are familiar with, Jim McKay.
Wide World of Sports, of course. He was
Wide World of Sports. Thing, yeah. It was the voice of the Olympics for many years, and it was the voice of the massacre in 1972 with the Israelis. Jim McKay was from Philadelphia, and you also work with Jack Whitaker, who was very prominent in Philadelphia with the golf and whatever. And Bob was a real pioneer in radio. Then he went over to WFIL, and he created a show on the radio called Bob Horn's Bandstand. Remember, it's about 1948, 1949. The only person who even was parallel to Bob Horn in that era was Ed Hurst of Grady and Hurst. They had the 950 Club, which was in competition with Bob with WPEN, which still exists. It's 950 AM in Philadelphia. Now, Bob's show was very successful, the same format that they had on television, but television was really at its inception in 1948, 1949. Not many people had TVs. And the show was really good. So Walter Annenberg, who was one of the principals behind Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan became the president, had an idea. He registered WFIL, the ABC affiliate, with the FCC in about 1948 for 17 cents. He owned WFIL in Philadelphia at 46th and Market. It's another thing I want your people to be aware of. Clark, in all of his books, said Bandstand took place in South Philadelphia. That's not true. It took place in West Philadelphia at 46th and Market. I used to go there when I was a kid. So it was 46th and Market, right over to Frankfurt Market elevated trains.
Was it Walter Annenberg that hired him, per se, or was it somebody else at the...
I would say, the owner of the station never... You've been in the field long.
That's why I've asked the question. Somebody else must have hired him.
Well, he was hired by Roger Clip and Jack Steck.
Roger Clip and Jack Steck.
Right. They're the main people in the management of WFIL in that specific era.
What can you tell us about Roger Clip?
Nobody liked Roger Clip. He was very friendly with Dick Clark's father, who it's been very evasive, but I uncovered his father was in pharmaceutical sales. He was pretty good friends with Roger Clip, which is unusual because nobody I ever interviewed liked Roger Clip. Jack Steck told me he was 87 years old at the time. He lived in Havertown.
Right.
And he told me, you couldn't buy a paper clip, pardon the pun, without the approval of Roger Clip. He ran the daily operation of the Annenberg Empire, whether it was the newspapers, whether it was radio, whether it was TV, whatever. Roger Clip was his day-to-day general manager. He was the man who you reported to, your boss.
Now, you make it very, very clear that almost from day one, Roger Clip did not like Bob Horn, and yet Roger... But was Roger really the one that hired him, or was it mostly Jack Steck?
I would say Steck probably
Steck,
hired
I'm sorry,
you
Steck.
Have to understand something. In that era, you're talking about somebody who was playing music. He was playing avant-garde type of music that was not accepted to... especially older people. They're playing the big bands or John Philip Sousa music. They were not playing rock and roll. Rock and roll was 5 to 7 years away from this. Bob was playing black music or race music long before Freed even.
Who
gets credit? Bob was playing it in a nighttime bandstand show about 11 o'clock at night. There's a lady in Philadelphia, and she's not in Philly anymore, but she was playing old-fashioned music like that, and she interviewed me. Her name is Raleigh James.
Oh, I know Raleigh, yes.
Yeah, Raleigh interviewed me a couple times. She plays obscure music of the era. Bob was doing.
Bob was hosting a radio show at this time called Bob Horn's Bandstand at that time on
that
the radio.
Dick Clark inherited Bob Horn's Bandstand, and they changed the name to Cavalcade of Stars.
But initially, we're talking like around, what, 1948? 48-49, Bob Horn is hosting a show on WFIL on the radio called Bob Horn's Bandstand at that time.
Late at night.
Late at night. What time at night was that?
I'd say 11 o'clock at night.
So if it was 11 o'clock at night, initially the show wasn't really for teenagers then, was it?
No, there was a guy in New York, if your old-timers are familiar, named Long John Nebel.
I remember, so I guess I'm an old-timer.
Well, Long John Nebel had a huge following in that era. And Bob played at night, and people used to listen to kids. Yeah. They would hide in their bedroom and play it on the radio because it was taboo because your parents did not like that type of music. It was the devil's music, and he played that type of music. And about 1952, Annenberg decided with Klip and I think probably Steck to put the Bandstand from the Radio on the television. They were last in the ratings. They had million-dollar movies in the afternoon, a 2:30 slot. And there was five high schools, I wouldn't say walking distance, but in 10, 15 minutes from the studio at 46th and Market. There was St. Tommy Moore, which was at 44th and Wyalusing. Then you had West Catholic for boys and West Catholic for girls. You had West Philly High School, and then they had the high school I went to, called Overbrook, where Will Chamberlain went to school, and the later day, Will Smith went to Overbrook High School. That's how it evolved into Bob Horn's Bandstand on the TV in September of 1952.
If I may just interrupt for a second, to clarify, when he was on the radio with Bob Horn's Bandstand at 11 o'clock in the evening, was it a two-hour show, or what was it at that time?
1 to 2 hours.
Okay.
I'm not completely sure.
Now, were there people that actually came into the radio studio and danced during that, or was it just playing records?
I would say probably not, because it was late at night.
How did Bob's show differ from the competition, which was Grady and Hurst?
Bob was probably more knowledgeable with music than Grady and Hurst.
Right, and he was playing more of the, what would then be called race music, R&B.
Different type of music he was playing. Now, Joe Grady, to his credit, I interviewed Joe Grady right before he died, total gentleman. I mean, we had a long, long discussion. He lived in Broomall, a suburb of Philly. And we had a long chat, and I asked him a lot of questions about Bob, and he told me Bob was a pro in every sense of the word. He knew the music, he knew what the people wanted, and he was a people person. That's what Bob Horn.
This is from a competitor, a friendly competitor.
From Joe Grady.
Joe Grady. Ed Hurst still around?
I don't know. I met Hurst. He's an insurance salesman. I don't know if he's still around.
Okay. So basically, what we're telling everybody is that what eventually evolved into American Bandstand began initially as a radio show with the title Bob Horn's Bandstand on WFIL, and this was 1948. And was the show on the radio doing pretty well?
Yes, very popular.
So it was really basically the TV that wasn't doing too good, the million-dollar
movie. TV was at its inception.
Right.
you have to understand something, Ronnie, that ABC was the new kid on the block. You only had three networks at that time. You had NBC, which was General Sarnoff in New York,
right.
And you had CBS, which was Pelé. And they were successful long before ABC.
Right.
So they had a buck competition,
right.
Which in that time, even though it was only two other stations, was entirely different than today, because if McDonald's opens up, Wendy's is going to be as successful as McDonald's, because people are acclimated to fast foods.
I see.
The same principle applies here. They were not acclimated to ABC or having another competitor. That's what happened.
We get to the TV and they're showing these million-dollar movies, which unfortunately, in terms of their impact, were like buck-and-a-half movies in terms of the reception.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed something to change.
They need to fill in.
And they decided to move Bob Horn's Bandstand to TV. That's a major change, isn't it? I would think.
Well, that was a pioneer type of a thing, because it was never done before. And you're talking about a pretty huge market. The Delaware Valley, people around the country can say, oh, it's a small market. It's about 10 million people.
I know.
Not a small market.
Not at all. So they made this decision. Of course, there's other things that are involved, like what are you going to show on camera? You have to have a set, and you have to have something going on to make it television rather than just video radio, so to speak. So tell me a little bit about that very first show, the preparations, and then, of course, the debut of Bob Horn's Bandstand on TV.
Well, it's a very small studio, Ronnie. It could only accommodate max 250 people, and they didn't know what to happen. At about 2:30, there was a couple kids who came in, and they thought the show would not really attract, at the start, a lot of people. But it really happened, and it filled up, and, you know, the show... They had made cards, like bandstand cards,
right.
The regulars. They made cards for the kids to come in. The show more or less evolved very quickly into a successful TV show. It was hot.
Going back to that first day, what date are we talking about in 1952?
Mid to latter part of September it started.
So this is the first day on the air as a TV show. They have a set, by the way, that kind of looks like, I'm looking at it on the front cover of your book. They have a picture of the actual set, and it looks like it's inside of a record store.
Mm-hmm.
It says record department, and then they have like a window, like looks like it's leading to the outside. You can see buildings on the outside, and you have all these kids. Now, when Bob Horn's Bandstand went on TV, what were the hours at that time initially?
I think it was about 2:30 or 2:45 to 5 o'clock. He was on longer than American Bandstand. He was on probably two and a quarter hours a day.
When he did the flash cut to TV, prior to that he was doing the radio show. But was the radio show still on at 11 o'clock at that time?
It was still on. I believe Clark was hired in 1951.
Right.
So Clark was doing the radio show at that time.
Okay, so we should point that out. Yeah. Dick Clark was doing the radio show, which was called, was that called Bandstand? What was it called?
Cavalcade of Stars.
Cavalcade of Stars. Okay, so Dick Clark was doing a show called Cavalcade of Stars. And we're going to get to something really interesting about Bob Horn and Dick Clark in just a few moments. But my point is that initially, Bob Horn's Bandstand was more adult-oriented, wasn't it? Because it was on so late at night, I would assume that it wouldn't have a huge...
It had a mixture. I would say there was closets of kids who listened to this music, but they wouldn't come out and say it because it was taboo. It wasn't accepted back then. But I would say his audience was a mixture of young men and also young adults.
Anyway, we get to the very first day. They were not using Bandstand Boogie as the theme. They were using a song performed by Bob Crosby's Bobcats.
That is correct.
And in fact, I happen to have a copy of it, so we're going to kind of paint the mood right now. This is the opening theme of Bob Horn's Bandstand. This is called High Society. The opening theme of Bob Horn's Bandstand as it made its TV debut in 1952. Initially, the show consisted not only of the dancing in the studio, but also what became, I guess you'd have to say, the forerunner of music videos, something called Snaders and something called Officials. Could you just clarify like what they were and what the difference between those two things were?
There were film clips that were supplied by James Roosevelt, a son of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, right after the Second World War. They were available. There would be film clips of some artists singing music from the era, like a little film, a little blur, of what you essentially see years later. They were an original, Snaders and Officials.
Functionally, they were the same.
Right.
Basically, these were performance videos, straight-ahead shots of the artist doing the songs.
That is correct. And it's crossover music long before rock and roll.
We're talking, of course, about pop music of the day. We're talking around 1952. At what point did they decide not to use these music videos, so to speak? Were they not working? Were they not well-received? Were there just not enough of them?
I think Tony Mamaroneau and Bob Horn wanted to have live performance lip sync their different songs. The first guest he ever had on the show was a gentleman by the name of Dizzy Gillespie, a trumpet player from South Philadelphia. About the second or third week of September 1952.
Interesting choice there, because Dizzy is an instrumentalist rather than a vocalist.
That's correct.
And not only that, but Dizzy Gillespie was far more associated with jazz music than popular music.
Again, this is prior to rock and roll. Some of the stars prior to rock and roll, you had Rosemary Clooney. Also, okay. Patty Page. The McGuire sisters were on there. Perry Como was on the show. Frankie Lane. And then you had a lady who was promoting her movie by the name of Debbie Reynolds. Pat Boone was on the show. Les Paul and Mary Ford. Also had a lady who made a terrific song by the name of Eileen Barton.
Oh,
if
yeah.
you knew you were coming out of Bake the Cake. Then you had another lady by the name of Teresa Brewer and Eddie Fisher. Then you had another guy who had a big, big hit called Cry.
Johnny Ray.
Tony Bennett. Georgia Gibbs appeared also.
So all these people appeared live?
Yes.
So basically, it's fair to say that the biggest pop music stars appeared on Bob Horn's Band.
It was the number one show.
It was the number one.
Steve Allen created The Tonight Show, and Mrs. Horn told me when I interviewed her initially that Steve Allen used to call Bob Horn for what's the latest hits. He was the man. Bob knew a hit in the first five or six bars of the song. He also discovered a black lady who became very, very big by the name of Pearl Bailey. Bob was big.
The biggest music stars of that particular time appeared on Bob Horn's Bandstand. That was the show to be on, and they were.
For the exposure, of course.
Later on, a lot of dances originated and were popularized on American Bandstand, but the fact is, Bob Horn also popularized dances.
Yes, he popularized a dance that they still do today called the Bunny Hop.
Tell me a little bit about that.
The Bunny Hop was created by a band leader by the name of Ray Anthony, and he premiered it on Bob Horn's Bandstand.
He actually made a personal appearance on Bandstand?
Yes, huge hit, the Bunny Hop. Not too many other songs came from that era. I would give Clark credit for The Pony, The Twist, Mashed Potatoes, The Stroll, because they came a little bit later.
But the Bunny Hop was the big rage in the 50s when it was presented and promoted on Bob Horn's Bandstand. You used to watch Bob Horn's Bandstand, and of course you watched the Dick Clark shows, Bandstand and American Bandstand. Were there any major differences between the two shows?
There's nothing that was changed. There was two things that was changed. Number one, the host was changed from Bob Horn to Dick Clark. And number two, it went network August 5th, 1957 with ABC. That's the only two things that changed.
As you think about these shows, there are a lot of elements, obviously, that made the show work. What do you think was, in your own mind, Stan, the most important element of the Bandstand shows?
Number one, the kids, if you ever seen the movie Hairspray, they would emulate the girls' hairdos or the guys, how they dressed, and they had a DA, which was a big hairstyle back then. They would emulate the dressing of the kids. That's number one. And also how they danced. These kids were stars in that era. They received tons of fan mail from whatever specific area in the Pennsylvania or New Jersey area that watched the show. In fact, Justine Carelli, who was probably the most popular girl ever on American Bandstand, told me she got about 10,000 pieces of mail. I can believe it. Justine and Bob were like icons. They were like what you see on Dancing with the Stars.
Were there big stars during Bob Horn's Bandstand, like where the kids were known by name?
Oh, sure.
Bob Horn actually has said it himself. He said that the real stars of the show are the kids.
Sure. Sure, they were the stars.
I am Ronnie Allen, talking to Stanley J. Blitz, who is the author of Bandstand, The Untold Story. And it's not untold anymore, because you've told it. This is the untold prior to you telling it after about, 14 years of research or something like that?
Very hard to research this book, Ronnie, because a lot of the files, I did my majority of my research at Temple University Urban Archives, and a lot of the Bob Horn files have been destroyed by fire. You have to understand another thing for your people, is that Bob was older. He was 36 years old when he hosted the show in 1952, and his last show in 1956, he was 40 years old, and the music was not accepted. They wanted a younger person host the show because it catered primarily to teenagers dancing to the music. They didn't accept that. If it was today, it really doesn't matter, but back then, image was more than it ever had been, because, you know, you right. could not have an older person talking to teenagers. It wasn't accepted.
He was not a teenager, but he was playing music that appealed to teenagers, and the audience became primarily a teenage audience. And the show took off. Actually, it had kind of a slow beginning the first day, because they were hoping to get teenagers come into the studio and dance, and in like the first few minutes, hardly anybody showed up. I mean, there had been announcements made and everything, but then all of a sudden, everybody started showing up, and within a few days, the show was an immediate hit, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. It was an immediate hit. Contrary to what Mr. Clark says, I read about four books. He doesn't write anything or has done the research. He said that the show was not successful. And when he got it, it became more successful. And that's his opinion. There's a lot of distorted facts from Mr. Clark. He claimed he integrated the dancers. And this book will show that Bob really integrated the dancers.
There's pictures.
I have a picture right there. Clark claimed he integrated the show in 1959, which is not true.
Well, I'm just looking at the pictures from the yearbook. You see, that's kind of refuted there.
Yeah.
When the show started, Bob Horn was doing it in partnership with somebody else.
He was doing it in partnership, Ronnie, with a fellow by the name of Lee Stewart. Now, Lee Stewart was the pitch man for Madman Munts TV. He would sell TVs, and because he was doing so well with that, the management decided to pair him and Bob Horn as his co-host. But that marriage only lasted for a short time. Say about a year.
Maybe about a year. Okay. He was supposed to be funny, but a lot of people didn't find him terribly funny.
Bob couldn't stand him.
Okay. That's a good way to put it. But here's the interesting thing. The show goes on the air. It's a huge success. And Bob's immediate superiors were a gentleman we mentioned named Roger Clip and somebody else named Kohler.
George Kohler.
So those were his two immediate superiors.
Correct.
I understand, based upon reading the book and going through certain pages a few times, Roger Clip did not like Bob Horn.
Roger Clip liked no one.
He liked no one, but
except for Mr. Clark. They
right.
bonded.
But you would think if the show was so successful, he would kind of swallow that and say, hey, yeah, the show is doing good. But I get the impression that almost from day one, almost from the day that the show went on the air, Roger Clip was thinking in terms of, well, who are we going to replace this guy with?
Well,
it's difficult.
The real story about that is, which I can just interject right now, Bob Horn was not his first choice to host the show. His first choice was Joe Grady. Joe Grady had the 950 Club long before Bob was on the radio.
Right.
But Joe Grady had a contract with a man by the name of Harry Silk, who
right.
owned Sunray Drugs. And he would not let Grady out of the contract with Sunray Drugs. So his second choice was Bob Horn.
I see. Well, the bottom line is that the show went on the air, became very popular, and one of the features that was implemented into the show was Rate a Record. Was that Tony Mamarella that came up with that, or was it somebody else? Was it Bob?
Bob came up with that.
Oh, that was Bob's idea. Okay.
Yeah.
Bob and Tony were pretty close, weren't they?
Yes, they were in a working relationship. Yes, they were very close. I doubt if they socialized, but they were of the same age, as opposed to Mr. Clark, who was about 14 years younger than Bob.
The show got good ratings. I assume that the advertisers were very happy with the show.
The sponsors were coming in like crazy. They had so many sponsors. Tasty Cake was one of the big sponsors. And
right.
then they had Coca-Cola. They had, you name it, they had Oscar Mayer. That was not the problem. They had sponsors. They were making money. That was not the issue. The main issue was his age.
Even though he was so successful, was it mostly his superiors that were... doesn't seem like his audience cared about his age. They were accepting.
No. It was his superiors, and also they resented Bob because Bob was a parallel in certain ways to Lenny Bruce in comedy. Lenny Bruce was 20 years ahead of his time. Bob knew the music. He didn't need Monday Morning Quarterback to read a sheet or whatever. He knew the music. He had his pulse on it. And they didn't like that because he knew. In fact, his family told me when I was down in Jacksonville, Florida, right after their mother died, that Bob, even when the Beatles had one of their first concerts in the United States, in Houston, Bob knew the music. The man was a music man. He was not a corporate figure. He was his own man. He was like a true entrepreneur long before that term was ever used.
I am Ronnie Allen, and I'm talking to Stanley J. Blitz, and the book we're talking about is Bandstand, The Untold Story, and it's been out there for 13 years, and it's still very much in print, and in just a few moments, we're going to tell you how you can get your copy of the book and behold not only what he's written, but see all these pictures, which are not available anywhere in any other publication. You could spend an afternoon just looking at all these pictures. It's like reliving a piece of history that many people wanted to bury, which is a shame, really. That's
better than American Graffiti, and leave it at that.
Okay, well, we will leave it at that. Stan, 1953 was an excellent year for Bob Horn's Bandstand. Now, the show originally was called Bob Horn's Bandstand. When did it stop being Bob Horn's Bandstand? When was the Bob Horn?
I would say about 1954, because Bob had gone up to New York. NBC wanted to go network with the show as early as 54. The book will point this out, too. 1954, he went up to New York with his manager, who happened to be the manager also of Jerry Blavitt, who's a Philadelphia personality. His manager's name was Nat Siegel. Bob promoted the first jazz concert ever in Philadelphia at the Academy of Music, and the main headliner that evening in 1945 was a lady by the name of Sarah Vaughan. About 1954, they changed it from Bob Horn's Bandstand to Bandstand, because management didn't like him at the start, and when they found out he was peddling the show to go up to New York and possibly go on NBC, they liked him even less, so they changed it to Bandstand.
Okay, now, was Dick Clark still doing the show?
He was on the radio, doing some commercials and whatever on TV at certain slots. He only hosted the show when Bob had the show one day in 5.5 years. Bob Horn did not trust Dick Clark. Mrs. Horn told me he did not trust him from the start.
They made Bob Horn do something that many, I guess, and probably yourself, find kind of demeaning. They asked Bob Horn to go into the studio where Dick Clark was doing a show and do the intro and the outro to Dick Clark's show. Was this around 54?
That is correct.
53 or 54 or around that?
I would say 54. Clark was a true novice. He did not know the business like Bob.
Right.
So Bob would introduce Dick Clark, because he ultimately became a booth announcer. He would introduce Dick Clark, and then after he finished his TV show or whatever, he had to run up and down unnecessarily to open and close Dick Clark's cavalcade of stars.
Now, Roger Clipp really was kind of enamored of Dick Clark. Is that
he had the look.
He was kind of looking ahead. Dick Clark, whatever age he was, you could deduct 10 years, that's what he looked like. He looked like one of the teenagers.
Exactly.
America's oldest teenager. And I get the impression, in fact, it's not just an impression, you've kind of made it clear that in your own mind, you feel that there's evidence that there was possibly a conspiracy to have Bob Horn removed from the show and replaced by Mr. Clark.
Well, it's like I said at the start, Bob was not their first choice. So he was looking, and Clark was on the radio. He was getting his experience, and the music just took off. 56 was the year everything happened,
had
Little Richard, Fats Domino,
true.
Elvis, and they were all youngsters, and rock and roll, people had a craving for it. And here you have a 40-year-old man hosting it, and the management, Roger Clipp, especially, because he was the decision person, felt that he didn't want an older guy, so they concocted different things about Bob in that span. And the book will point these things out, because I don't want to tell you too much, because
I'd
like to get some sales.
I agree. It gets to a point now. In 1954, there was a change, and Bob's partner was dropped from the show.
Correct.
Was he just fired? Was it a mutual thing?
Back then, it was different than today. They didn't get a golden parachute like $25 million. I would say they called him into the office. Maybe they gave him a couple weeks' pay or whatever, and it's not working out. Thank you very much. And he left. That's how it was done back then.
I got the impression, just reading this book, that actually Clipp and... Now, was Kohler as hardened toward Bob Horn as Clipp was, would you say? Was Kohler the one that if you said jump, he would jump? I mean, was he the one?
Yeah, he was a yes man.
He was like the froggy that jumped?
Yeah, I met Kohler and I had lunch with
okay.
him, I think I mentioned
right.
to you.
Right.
And he was the type of a guy, he would, like the wind blew south, he would go south.
Right.
somebody said something and they were successful, he would be on their bandwagon. He was not the decision maker.
Right.
He was the station manager. And he reported the clip. And Clip said, jump rope. Like you said, he would jump rope.
Froggy jumps.
That's right.
All right. So Stewart is gone, and Bob Horn is still hosting the show. And I get the impression that Clip in particular was, I mean, if you want to look at villains here, you know, you say, well, Clip was the villain, because Clip definitely wanted Bob Horn gone.
An analogy today, even though he's an obnoxious human being, is Barry Bonds. In baseball, nobody likes Barry Bonds, but he produces and he stayed with the team. Doesn't play anymore, but the point is, nobody liked Barry Bonds.
I don't want to give too much away here, but I do want to let people know that Roger Clip and maybe others at the state, now Annenberg seemed to be supportive of Bob Horn for most of us.
He didn't care.
So he didn't really care. He kind of delegated this to other people, basically.
In fact, I think Annenberg liked Bob Horn.
Okay, but it seemed like Clip was looking for an excuse to be able to somehow get Horn out of there. And that excuse kind of came along. Reading this, I don't know if it was a setup or what, but there was a DWI involving Bob Horn, and for somebody else it might have been a minor thing, but for a public personality like Bob Horn, this was obviously a major thing, particularly if people like Clip were trying to get him out. So there were a series of events, and I think it would probably be better if we don't reveal all the details of this in this interview and let people who are interested buy the book. But there was a morals charge against Bob Horn, and then there was a second DWI against Bob Horn, so it was like a triple whammy.
Yeah, but I have to interject something.
Sure, absolutely.
About these two DWIs. I read the doctor's report before I did this book. Bob was under the limit for being drunk.
So he's innocent.
He was really innocent. It was a Dr. Scolisi or something. I read his all. He was under the alcohol limit. They just wanted to get rid of him in any way possible. They had setups and whatever. Was it a setup to get rid of him? It's up to the reader to decide that.
That's part of the mystery.
That's the mystery.
Yeah.
My opinion is Clip wanted him out. Bob had to be somebody who would do the show, go home, have dinner, and go to sleep.
Right.
He had to be somebody squeaky clean, and there's nobody squeaky clean. I don't care who the individual is in any walk of life. Everybody has skeletons in their closet.
Absolutely. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Is that what the expression is?
That's exactly right.
Were we talking about him being innocent? Was this the first DWI charge you're saying that he was innocent?
Well, any of them.
Any of them.
I read the doctor's report.
Was he found innocent?
No, he went to prison.
The first DWI, he went to prison?
When he left Philadelphia, he moved to Houston, and they brought him back from Houston. He served about 2 months in Moyamensing Prison.
This was for the first, not the morals thing, which I think he was acquitted of.
No, he was acquitted.
He was acquitted of that.
That's an ugly story.
Well, we don't want to go into that. We'll just say that it existed. After the first DWI happened, did he lose his job immediately? Was he fired? What happened?
No, he did not lose his job. What happened was they gave him a leave of absence. He went down to Wildwood. He was hosting record hops. Like, the people today see these record hops around town, like Jerry Blavitt does it, Bob Pantano, mm-hmm. a couple other Philadelphia old-time personalities. Bob was the creator of this long before these characters did it. So he went down to Wildwood. He was doing these dances, the sock hops. And then about June of 1956, which I uncovered through my research, Bob was not fired. Clark said in countless books that Bob Horn was fired. He was not fired. They had a meeting, management, and they decided he was offered to be the music director of WFIL and co-host the show he created with Dick Clark.
And he didn't want
that's
it.
That's stupid, because let's be realistic. If you create something and some novice comes in, do you want to work under them as something you created, whatever it might be?
No.
So Bob resigned. That's really what happened. He was not fired. He turned it down because he had an offer from Houston, Texas, from one of the creators of the Top 40s by the name of Gordon McClendon. Yeah, he was uprooted to Houston, Texas, June or July of 1956. Jerry Blavitt and Bob's son, Peter Horn, took him to Houston, Texas, and Bob was on the radio in Houston, Texas on KILT. I met the station manager, Bill Weaver. I had an extensive interview. He told me he never saw Bob take a drink. Bob was on the air for about 4 to 5 weeks. His style was not conducive to Houston in the 50s, and he was delegated to a sales job with the radio station.
And he started an advertising agency.
Bob Horn is a unique individual. He was born...
He was born Donald Roy Horn or something.
Right, and he changed his name to Bob Horn. Then he became Bob Adams in Houston. He changed his name for the agency to Bob Adams Agency. He was the creator of Midnight Madness with Walgreens. He's a very creative man.
The book is called Bandstand, The Untold Story. And before we say our goodbyes, Stan, there's one thing we have not covered, and that is, for those who would like to get a copy of your book, how do they go about doing so?
To purchase my book, I will personally autograph each and every copy. The price of the book is $24.95, and this book is 14 years of research and something I really wanted to do since I'm 16 years old, because I never believed the story of the creator of Bandstand could be so terrible as the media had made him. And I feel that this is a piece of American history. You'll learn about who Bob Horn was and how he created Bandstand that ultimately became American Bandstand. And even the shows the people see on New Year's Eve, New Year's Rockin' Eve was the idea of the creator of Bandstand, Mr. Bob Horn. Dick Clark had nothing to do with these things. He inherited it. This book does not malign Dick Clark in any way possible. It's about how Bandstand evolved into American Bandstand. And the price of the book is $24.95. You can send it to my distribution center, check, money order, or cashier's check. And you can send it to 704 Lenox, L-E-N-O-X Avenue, Las Cruces, L-A-S-C-R-U-C-E-S, New Mexico, N-M, 88005. And I'll be delighted if you have questions that you put in the envelope you'd like to have answered. I'll be more than delighted to answer any and all questions pertaining to this topic.
I'm just going to repeat the address. It's Stan Blitz, 704 Lenox, or Lenox, L-E-N-O-X, Avenue, Las Cruces, C-R-U-C-E-S, New Mexico, or N-M, 88005. Do I get an A-plus for that?
When I come into Philly, you and your wife, I'm taking you both out.
I'm going to hold you to that, Stan.
Well, I mean it.
Stan, thank you so much for doing the show with me. We will close with Barry Manilow's tribute to American Bandstand, which started out as Bob Horn's Bandstand, because I happen to like what Barry did with the Bandstand boogie theme.
Thank you for a great interview.
We're going hopping, hop. We're going hopping today. We think of hopping, hop. The Philadelphia way. We're going to drop it, hop. On all the music they play on the Bandstand. We're going swinging, swing. We're going to swing in the crowd, and we'll be clinging, swing. And floating high as a cloud, the phones were ringing, swing. My mom and dad are so proud, I'm on Bandstand. And I'll jump and hey, I may even throw my handstand. Because I'm on the American Bandstand. When we dance, we'll slow the show, all the guys in the grandstand. What a swinger I am on American. We're going hopping to stay, we think of hopping, the Philadelphia way, we're going to drop it, on all the music they play, on the Bandstand.
Bandstand.
Here we go, ready to go, but a pro, hey, I'm making my mark, see this joint is jumping. They make such a fuss just to see it go right. Hey, it's Mr. Dick Clark. What a place you got here. Swell spot, the music's hot here. Beverly Heath, give it at least a 75. Now for all you show, it goes by American Handstand.
singer tuning. He gave the greatest machine, my baby tuning, in front of all the TV. So if you tune in, you'll see my baby and me on the bandstand. And now we're hopping, and we'll be hopping all day. We think of popping, hell of every way. And you can drop in on all the music they play on the bandstand. And we'll rock and roll and stroll on American Lindy Hop and Flop. It's American. Do it in, I'm on, turn on, I'm in, I'm on.
To Ronnie remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.